Welcome to Shanahan on Literacy, the site where we believe there is nothing more noble than to teach somebody to read. I'm Tim Shanahan, your host, and today we're going to talk about benchmark testing, how to do the best benchmark testing. I received a letter from a teacher, and I've shortened the letter a bit, but here's what she has to say. Dear Dr. Shanahan, I have been searching for research around student testing. Could you point me in the direction of relevant research? Does testing time of the day make a difference? Does it matter if the testing proctor is that student's teacher for that subject? What effect does testing over several days and short bursts have? With the state test, all grades are tested on the same day at the same time, but our benchmark tests are different. We give those 3 times a year, a test with 4 passages and 35 questions taking about 2 hours to complete. Students are tested within their ELA or math class for several days over a week for the benchmark. My students get into the testing groove and then they must stop. They have about 30 minutes of testing time each day. Every day it is harder for them to get into the groove. They stop reading and start just clicking away. Our morning classes do better than those tested after lunch. We lose 13 to 15 days each year of instruction within ELA for the district benchmarks. I think the tests should be completed like the state tests. My colleagues argue that 1, teachers would feel better administering tests to their students. 2, the teachers who do not teach ELA or math would lose instructional time. And 3, non-testing teachers don't want to be responsible for administering the benchmark. Currently, only 30% of our students meet state standards on the state test. The benchmark is higher than that. Well, here's my response. I'm so old that I can remember a time in schools that students took few standardized tests. Teachers might improvise an arithmetic test or perhaps use the exercises in a review unit for that purpose. But reading tests were unusual in most regular classrooms, and instruction outside the classroom wasn't common either. This was before Title I and IDEA funding. Teachers determine kids' reading ability mainly by listening to them read during lessons, and their judgments were subjective. That's how they determine reading group assignments and what to tell parents about little Johnny or Janie's reading. Kids might not even know they were being evaluated. That may sound idyllic to some, even to me at times, but that system allowed lots of kids to fall through the cracks. If Mrs. Smith didn't know what to do with one of her struggling charges, there was a good chance she could just ignore the problem with no one the wiser. Likewise, the incompetent reading teacher could soldier on without any need for improvement, as long as her classroom was orderly, that is. These days, everyone, school administration, the state, the newspapers, all seem to be peeking over a teacher's shoulder. Unfortunate test scores may end a superintendent's term. Perhaps there'll be a new curriculum or a new regime of professional development. Kids get pulled out or pushed back in based on those scores. The idea of benchmark testing is to identify problems before the official evaluation, the state test, reveals that publicly. It gives districts, schools, teachers, and students a chance to address a looming problem before it becomes a public one. That, however, only works if the benchmark tests do a good job of predicting. The tests must be reliable. That means that student performance needs to be consistent. The tests have to be valid, meaning the tests manage to identify the kids and only those kids who will eventually fall short on the state test. And efficient, they shouldn't be costly financially or in terms of instructional time. Given the length of the tests that you describe, my guess is that they're reliable. Tests that long usually are. Given that the benchmark test is somewhat harder than the state test, I presume adequate validity, the benchmark should be harder since the cost of failing to address the needs of a struggler is higher than that of giving extra tuition to a youngster who would succeed anyway. A few more kids may get more reading help than is necessary, but this isn't a real loss since that additional teaching still may boost these kids' performances. To be certain of the validity, you would need to compare the list of kids who received extra support because of the benchmark test with the students who fall short on the state test. Certainly, all or most of the kids who fall below standard on the end of year test should be flagged by the benchmark test. How many were missed? The larger the number, the less valid your test. I'd also be curious about how many kids benchmark low and state tested high. This difference may suggest that both the predictor and the remedial teaching are sound, since the regime would appear to be protecting those kids from failure. How about the efficiency? Well, here I have serious doubts. This testing protocol is depriving kids of lots of instruction, 13 to 15 days. That's problematic because kids in middle school typically don't change that much in reading over a three-month period. It appears that you've adopted a practice that makes lots of sense with foundational skills in the primary grades and are applying it to seventh grade reading comprehension. Two very different animals. In the primary grades, kids' decoding and fluency skills change frequently. Close monitoring can keep kids from slipping through the cracks. That's a good thing. But when you're 12, reading comprehension doesn't change that much over short periods of time. I suspect that most of those kids repeatedly ace the benchmarks or fail them. I bet the numbers of kids who swing between categories are small, and that most of that shifting is due mainly to the unreliability in the tests rather than to changes in what kids know. This practice, monitoring kids' reading status, makes so much sense that people aren't thinking about it clearly. Your district's approach is akin to the bubble kid strategy. The state determines your success by the numbers who do better than a certain score. We could try to improve reading instruction for everybody, or we could focus our resources mainly on the kids on the bubble, that is, the ones who come close to the magic score but just don't quite get there. In some schools, principals aim to make their school look better by dragging those kids across the line. Let's say 325 is the target score. Those principals will devote all remedial resources to kids with scores in the range of 310 to 324. They're neither trying to teach everyone, nor are they trying to teach anyone very much. They just want a few more kids across that line. Thank goodness your district's approach doesn't seem to pose the same ethical problems as this, since it should ensure that even those far below the target score will get help. And in your case, it's a large percentage of the boys and girls who obviously need extra help. Nevertheless, it seems likely that your successes, the kids predicted to fail who eventually succeed, are surely bubble kids. When states choose such a single, narrow assessment goal, school districts will respond. If a state wants more kids across that line, then resources swing towards the kids near the line. What if a state emphasized average reading scores instead? I'm not touting that as a superior goal. It isn't, but it would lead to different pedagogical strategies and perhaps better strategies for your situation. Perhaps there would be a greater emphasis on the quality and quantity of classroom instruction instead of targeted remedial assistance. It would be the rare school willing to sacrifice 13 to 15 days of valuable instruction for testing that mainly provides information that they already know. And I'd have to say, if such a high percentage of your kids are failing to meet standards, reducing instruction that much is really a serious problem. It would be smart to reduce the amount of unnecessary testing. I feel sorry for the kids who never pass the state test, but who must engage in 13 to 15 days of testing each year to qualify for the extra help. At some point, you'd think adults would show some compassion for them. Why not concede the point, skip the testing, and help them anyway? Kids who test far above the cut point may not be as frustrated, but there's no benefit for them in this either. Yep, I'm proposing something really crazy. More teaching, less testing. As to your specific questions, from the research, I don't think those variations in testing practices matter that much. Time of day. Does time of day matter in kids' test performance? At NWEA, the MAP testing people, data shows that kids do best early in the day on their reading and math tests, and they fade as the day goes on. Their solution? To get the best scores, test in the morning and not after lunch. This goes along with an earlier study, this one from Denmark, that reported lower test scores as the day goes on. 8 a.m. scores were better than 9 a.m., 9 better than 10, and so on throughout the day. Though they also found that providing break time prior to the testing minimized this fall off. Students showed greater cognitive persistence early in the day, and work breaks allowed them to recharge or regain their freshness. Now that sounds reasonable, until you read some other studies. For instance, Kusick and company found that time of day made no difference in testing performance. According to that study, test time had no impact on how well kids did on tests. Still another investigation contradicted this finding, reporting that the best performances were accomplished, wait for it, after lunch. You heard it. Kids either do better in the morning or the afternoon, except when it doesn't matter. That sounds like a noise factor to me. Your observation that morning kids outperform the afternoon crew is easy enough to check with your own data. First, make sure that those groups are equivalent. Compare the class averages using their previous year's state test scores. If they're very close, then compare the morning and afternoon benchmarks. Is one set markedly higher than the other? Such a comparison should reveal whether this is a problem or not. While you're at it, I'd get the district's testing people to correlate separately these groups' benchmark scores with their end-of-year state test scores. Benchmarking is used to predict success on the state test. If the correlations differ much, then you're likely doing a better predicting job at some time of the day. Of course, if the correlations aren't that different, then this set of research studies is probably correct. Time of day is not meaningfully or consistently impacting your kids' performance, at least not in any way that matters. Proctoring. Research shows that students do perform better when their classroom teacher is the test proctor. Your hunch is correct. That makes sense, but why the score boost from a familiar teacher? The researchers who did this study assumed familiarity reduced anxiety. The students could relax and do their best in their customary situation. Now that may be, but an interesting twist is introduced when you listen to teachers' own explanations of how they handle test administration, and we get that from another study. In this study, many third-grade teachers admitted they would not be scrupulous in following test administration procedures because they wanted to support, quote, students to do their best work, to provide, quote, a positive testing experience for the students, and to maintain their usual, quote, pedagogical routines and their relationships with the students. In other words, they would administer the tests in ways that they thought might boost the scores. These benchmark tests are not high-stakes exams. Their only purpose is to identify who should get additional help. There would be no logical reason for teachers to artificially heighten these scores. Nevertheless, experience tells me that many teachers do exactly that anyway. Instead of trying to make sure that everyone who needs it gets the help they need, these teachers are trying to make their scores look better. I don't like putting the teacher's interests into conflict with the student's interests. I think this practice is doing that. Some things teachers may do, like offering encouragement during the testing, have not been found to be particularly effective, so probably doesn't matter if the teachers do that or not. However, that doesn't mean they can't goose the score somehow. For instance, one study reported that extending testing times a bit could make the scores look better, even for the high achievers. That would be an example of an inappropriate way that familiar proctoring may help kids to do their best work. It's not really their best work. I doubt that proctoring differences matter much in terms of overall scores, but I'd remind your teachers that if they manage to boost kids' scores inappropriately, it will deprive them of needed help. Teachers care about their students, so make sure they really know what is best for the kids. And finally, short burst testing. I know of no research on this practice, but 4 days of testing 3 times a year seems like overkill to me. As noted earlier, I'd strive for a program that did less testing and more teaching. To sum up, in terms of these concerns, if you want your test to be highly predictive of the state test results, then you would want the prediction power of your benchmark testing to be high. One way to increase those correlations is to make the predictor tests as much like the criterion as possible. That means making the tests highly similar in their design and in how they're administered. It's possible that realigning the benchmarking to be more like the end of your test could improve your predictions. By how much is the question? I think you'd do better focusing your deep thinking on figuring out how to extensively reduce the sheer amount of unnecessary and uninformative testing that this regime now requires. With such a large percentage of kids in your school failing to meet state standards, that seems to be, to me, the most pedagogically and morally appropriate approach to take going forward. And with that, that'll be my last word on benchmark testing today. If you would like to get a written copy of this, you can go to the Shanahan on Literacy website. Look for how to do the best benchmark testing. This posts on July 12, 2025, and so you can find it there and download it. Getting the written copy also allows you to obtain the 4 research references that were included in this particular presentation. With that, I would like to take this opportunity to thank our sound engineer, Greg Johnson. I'd like to just mention, Greg Johnson is a California teacher who has volunteered his spare time, and I know teachers have just lots of spare time. Greg has volunteered some of that time to engineering the sound on this so that you can actually listen to this and get whatever you're getting out of it. And so I want to thank Greg, and I just thought you might like to know that he's doing this as a volunteer gig, and that's really pretty terrific. Finally, I'd like to thank you for tuning in. I look forward to seeing you up the road a piece.